NPR.com. I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. If you think these are tumultuous times, with a government shutdown, a nation said to be near the brink of default, and political rancor at a seeming all-time high, a new book by historian Brenda Wineapple reminds us of an even more riotous earlier period, packed with events that almost test belief. A small band of men, backed by wealthy slave owners, attempts to annex Cuba. A U.S. senator is knocked senseless on the chamber floor by a rival congressman. And a population of fiercely independent Mormons faces off against the federal government, leading to the Utah War. And most importantly, the country was in the throes of its most vehement debate ever about slavery and states' rights that would culminate in the Civil War. The book is called Ecstatic Nation, Confidence, Crisis, and Compromise. It spans the years 1848 to 1877 and explores the political, cultural, and intellectual history of the era. The cast of characters includes not only leaders like Abraham Lincoln, Jefferson Davis, or activists such as Frederick Douglass or John Brown, but also weaves in literary figures, Emily Dickinson, Herman Melville, Henry Thoreau, newspaper men such as Horace Greeley, and even the showman P.T. Barnum, whose American Museum displayed the likes of bearded ladies, four-legged chickens, and educated dogs. Today in The Exchange, we explore this remarkable period in our history and the equally remarkable individuals who shaped it. Let's hear from you. Join us with your questions and comments. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Professor Wineapple joins us from a studio in New York City. And Brenda Wineapple, great to have you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, first of all,
delighted to be here.
You named the book Ecstatic Nation, Brenda, and I have to ask you about that because the word ecstatic suggests extreme joy, right? But your book addresses the Civil War and the extremely difficult, contentious, violent years leading up to it, the years afterwards, which were, as you tell us, almost equally as violent. So why ecstatic?
It's a good question. The phrase Ecstatic Nation comes from a poem by Emily Dickinson, and it seemed to capture for me what you call the extremes of this particular period, the tumult. On the one side, the optimism, the energy, the excitement, the sense of hope that culminates in freedom, liberation, finally the demise of slavery. But at the same time, ecstatic, if you think about it, also suggests a kind of delirium, a kind of fanaticism, a kind of frenzy. And in either case, great joy or great frenzy, there's a kind of denial, too, of the realities of a situation. So I thought ecstatic would give us a sense of the whole nation, both the positive and negative, both the violence and the liberation of this particular period.
Yeah, optimism and a sense of hope. Again, those aren't words that people usually ascribe to this period, Brenda.
Well, you know, when you think about it, that's absolutely true because you have the Civil War and the numbers keep growing of how many dead there actually were on the battlefields and collaterally. But what led up to the Civil War is the sense that you could change the nation, that you could make a country that was finally dedicated to its ideals, that you could have equality for all men, black and white, and all women, too. So there was that sense of hope, the sense that finally we could, you know, create the more perfect union that the and the ideals that the country was founded on. And without hope, you can't have the kind of real revolution that occurred both during the Civil War and afterwards, regardless of the cost.
Well, the Civil War, as you well know, I'm sure, has much been covered. There's probably hundreds, maybe thousands of books on this period in American history. So how challenging was that for you, Brenda? What sort of new ideas or new hope, new take did you hope to bring to the table?
Well, you're right. It's a tremendous challenge. And many, many people have come to the Civil War before me and covered all aspects of it, and every aspect of it has about 100 books on it. What I wanted to do is create a path through the the lead up to the war, and the aftermath that seemed fresh, that give you some of the events that you know about, Appomattox, Lincoln's assassination, the Emancipation Proclamation, but gave it to you in a very new way so that you could see the war in the context of what happened before, the people who helped create it and wanted to prevent it, and then what happened afterwards, both in terms of Reconstruction, but also what happens to the country after a great and divisive war like the Civil War was. So I thought what I would do is, as I said, come to this almost as an ingenue, come to this as if I was coming from another planet and reading the newspapers of the time in the 1850s or in the 1870s and try to figure out what it was that was going on the ground as people experienced it. And that's why early on, as you mentioned before, I begin the book in Cuba. You don't expect the issues of the Civil War to begin with a group of men from America, from the United States, trying to take over Cuba. But that represents the expansionism of the so-called slave empire. They wanted to move south and create more slave states. So I thought that would be a kind of surprise and yet very much part of the history of what happens.
Yeah, it is a surprise to open up this book about the Civil War period. You expect to open it up and read about, you know, Abraham Lincoln in his log cabin or something. So let's talk about that then, because, you know, many listeners no doubt know about the sort of westward ho, you know, go west, young man, during this time period, the clashes with Native Americans, and we'll talk about those later for sure. But most people probably don't remember this southern expansion, the desire to annex Cuba and other southern nations, perhaps.
Yes, take what you can. I mean, this was the outgrowth of what was called manifest destiny. And often when we think of that term that was coined in the period before, that the United States had a destiny to expand, we think of the West, and that certainly was happening. But also there were many entrepreneurs, cotton planters, speculators, and just young people sort of imbued with the idea of freedom who thought, they could go south and they could liberate Cuba, so to speak, from the Spanish and then bring it into the American growing country. But a lot of the Southerners who were interested in doing this were interested in expanding slavery south because they knew that it wasn't going to go north and that would really keep their power and keep a nice economic base for them as well. Of course, the whole idea was ridiculous. It violates neutrality laws that the United States has with other countries. And as we've even learned today, you just can't send a group of men and say, hello, I'm here to take your country.
Well, so Cuba, what other southern destinations were Americans?
Nicaragua.
Nicaragua.
A little bit later on, Nicaragua. And there was a man named William Walker who tried at least three times to go overturn the government of Nicaragua and bring it into America. And as I said, these were, they seem idiosyncratic. It seems eccentric that people would do this. But actually, there were economic motives for doing this. But these, what they were called, the filibusters, not the kind we think of today when people stand up in Congress and talk for 24 hours without a bathroom break. These were people who were going into countries to take them over. The origin of the word means freebooter. And fortunately for everyone's sake, none of these expeditions were successful. But I think they tell you a lot about the need for new markets that the South felt and the need for power.
Yeah, and as you said, Brenda, these efforts at Southern expansion were always in tension with slavery, stretching back to the founding of the country. So just untangle the politics of that for us. Why these slave states were interested in Cuba, in Nicaragua. It was a sort of a counterbalance, a balance-counterbalance thing that was going on all the time.
Yes, because many of the slave states were afraid that the North was getting too much power. It was getting industrial power. This was after the Industrial Revolution. It was empowered, you might say, from the anti-slavery movement, too, which was growing in leaps and bounds. That was the origin of the Republican Party at that particular time in the late 1850s. So the South felt more and more hemmed in and realized that they weren't going to be able to maintain the same balance of power in Congress and even in the executive that they had enjoyed previously. So by finding new states and finding new land, they felt that they would then recreate the balance of power and maybe even tip it against the North. So what you have here is a real struggle that went on both on the ground, but, in Congress.
So how interested, I have to ask you this because we're in New Hampshire, how interested was President Franklin Pierce of New Hampshire in this Southern expansion, Cuba, Nicaragua,
whatever?
He was
very interested in it. You would think that Franklin Pierce coming from New Hampshire would be part of the anti-slavery movement, which is often associated with all of New England. The anti-slavery movement is, of course, complicated and it has many factions within it. But Franklin Pierce wasn't part of that at all. And when he ran for president in 1852, it came in as a kind of dark horse. But he won by a landslide, particularly because I think Southerners liked him. He was a Democrat, an old Jacksonian Democrat. And he was campaigning on a platform of silence, not saying too much. But he sympathized with the needs and the outlook of the South. And for that reason, he was in office when some very troublesome legislation was passed, namely the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which really allowed those territories in the West to decide for themselves whether or not they would permit slavery. And that was a change from what was called the Compromise of 1850, which more or less put a lid on the expansion of slavery. So in many ways, Franklin Pierce, a New Hampshire hero, was a complicated kind of person to have in the office if you were from New Hampshire and anti-slavery.
All right. And after a short break, I want to ask you, Brenda, about some of the cultural figures that you weave into this book. And we'll start taking your calls and questions, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. When you become a sustaining member of NHPR at the $15 a month level, we'll send you a special thank you gift. For a limited time, you can get the NHPR Blue Nano Speaker. The pocket-sized Bluetooth-enabled speaker can be yours when you support the new service you love with a $15 sustaining gift at nhpr.org today. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Epic Oriental Rugs of Hampton, offering over 2,500 new and antique Oriental rugs, as well as repair, restoration, hand-washing, and appraisal services. More at epicorientalrugs.com. From Hinckley Allen, attorneys at law who believe a lawyer should come referred. For more information about Hinckley Allen and the clients they serve is online at hinckleyallen.com. And Fuller Sugar House on Main Street in Lancaster, producer and retailer of pure New Hampshire maple syrup and maple products. Sugar House open daily, fullersugarhouse.com. Becoming partly sunny today with highs low to mid-60s. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, our guest is historian and author Brenda Wineapple. We're talking about her new book, Ecstatic Nation, Confidence, Crisis, and Compromise, 1848 to 1877. It's a character-driven look at the three decades surrounding the Civil War. Join us with your questions and comments about this amazing period of our history, New Hampshire's connection to it, or your own family's connection to it. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Brenda, let's just for a moment turn away from sort of the well-known characters of this time period. You know, Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Pierce, Jefferson Davis, who turns out to be the president of the Confederacy. What I like about this book is you're weaving in of cultural figures, big cultural trends, inventions like the daguerreotype, which became the photo, to the seance craze where people were convinced they could speak to the dead. I mean, it's incredible. Let's talk first of all about the daguerreotype. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. And how that evolved to really create what you call the culture of celebrity.
Yes, absolutely. The daguerreotype is a forerunner, as you say, of the photograph. And photography is so important in this particular period because, as you suggested, part of the ecstatic is the sense of, as I say in the subtitle, the sense of confidence that you could do new things and suddenly you could stop time and you could see people. You could take pictures of people and you could carry those little photographs with you in a leather-bound case with you wherever you went, which was important, I think, became important during the war because many people had, almost as if they were baseball cards, pictures of their favorite generals, or in the case of Davis and Lincoln, their favorite president. But the whole evolution of photography was part of this period, and actually the Civil War was the first war that was photographed from beginning to end privately by photographers who were going out to the front. So we have a whole document, you know, a whole series of documents of this particular war, which makes it, I think, very chilling to us and chilling to the people who experienced it because these photographs were turned into lithographs and appeared in the newspapers of the time. So you saw these terrible battlefields and you felt the chill, actually, of being there. And in some sense, these photographs became anti-war. But at the same time, people turned into photographs. And as I said, having them like baseball cards created what you're calling the culture of celebrity. Even Abraham Lincoln, when he was running for president first time, sat for a photograph in a photography studio, and then that particular photograph was distributed so people could see what he looked like and have a personal relationship with him. So it's really remarkable if you think back to a time where this didn't exist. Now we have cell phones and can take pictures anywhere, but there was this particular period, there was none, and then suddenly there were pictures. Then after the war, what became interesting was that many of these photographers who had photographed battlefields went out west, and they went out west with the various surveys of the landscape, and some of the most beautiful pictures of the West are from these same photographers who were on the ground at that particular time in the war. So it's a very interesting period that's documented both the landscape, the beauty of the landscape, and the horrors of what people could do to one another.
Well, and it's often said in our time that the first televised debates between Nixon and Kennedy really reshaped American politics. You're saying
that's
the same
true.
Thing happened back then.
I think it absolutely did. You know, I think it changed our whole relationship to time. We could have, there was a sense that we could stop time. You see the photographer becoming a character in an early novel by Nathaniel Hawthorne called The House of the Seven Gables. And we don't really even associate Hawthorne with this period, but he was very much part of this period. We mentioned Franklin Pierce. They were very good friends. So it's unusual that suddenly photography becomes very much part of the consciousness of Americans and something that they respond very strongly to. And everybody wants their picture taken.
Well, I love the idea of people walking around with, you know, their favorite general or their favorite president and so forth. And, you know, we think of Abraham Lincoln as so pure and above it all. But you say he was pretty shrewd about using this new technology.
Absolutely. He was a consummate politician. And I mean that as a compliment. These days when you say somebody's a politician, you mean they're, you know, devious and shifty and all of that. But he would never have gotten elected or stayed elected or been able to manage in many ways the war and almost the aftermath of the war, though he didn't live to see it, without being a very shrewd self-promoter and one who was going to be able to use the next new technologies to his advantage. Even the railroad, you know, going from place to place and what was became called a kind of whistle-stop tour. Abraham Lincoln and then after him Andrew Johnson were going to be able to use these technologies in ways that were going to keep them, they hoped, in office. Nothing wrong with that.
Again, it's interesting because we look at this period and we think Civil War, slavery. Mm-hmm. That's all we think about. Mm-hmm. But there's all these other undercurrents. I also want to invite our listeners again to join us at 1-800-892-6477. If you have questions or comments or thoughts about this amazing period in American history, the book is Ecstatic Nation. The author is Brenda Wineapple. The period it covers is 1848 to 1877. So the buildup to the Civil War and those very difficult years of Reconstruction afterwards. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And I do want to ask you, Brenda, about the literary figures who are woven throughout this book. They're so important, and they're there at the beginning, they're there at the end, they're there all the way through. You know, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Herman Melville, Emily Dickinson, newspaper men like Horace Greeley, a huge, huge figure. What role did these writers play in this tumultuous period?
Well, from, you know, in a very simple sense, they lived through it and they were writing about it. Another person of this period who lived through the entire period, because Hawthorne died, you know, before the war ended, was Walt Whitman, the poet. And Walt Whitman saw Lincoln from afar in Washington. Walt Whitman went to the battlefield looking for his brother and then became a nurse in Washington. Walt Whitman saw the rise of the Gilded Age, was kind of horrified by it, and he documented all of this in his poetry. And there were people who were responding to that poetry. Herman Melville, the same thing. You can read Moby Dick as a kind of foreshadowing in many ways of the war, with, if you want to, Ahab as a kind of secessionist. But during the war, Melville stopped writing fiction and started writing poetry, and poetry really that captured the bleakness and the fears and the anxieties and the hope that war was involved. Take another figure like Louisa May Alcott, very interesting. We think of her as Little Women, you know, writing that particular book, which is also in the period after the war, but during it, she too went to Washington to become a nurse, and like so many people, became ill. She caught typhoid, and her father came and brought her back home, and many say she was never quite the same again. And then, of course, the sort of consummate literary figure of this particular time is Harriet Beecher Stowe, and you know, it was said, I'm not sure it's true, but it's a great story, that when Lincoln met Harriet Beecher Stowe, he said, "So you're the little woman who started this great war." And she did, in some ways, with Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was a roaring and huge bestseller, and it was an anti-slavery novel.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, sure, Harriet Beecher Stowe, people might associate her with the era, with the huge debate over slavery. But you don't think of poets or authors like Louisa May Alcott, poets like Walt Whitman. You think of poets as kind of, you know, especially Walt Whitman, just gently writing about Leaves of Grass, right? I mean, you don't think of him as
you know, but it's interesting because, you know, he's writing about Leaves of Grass in the period before, 1855, and he's saying, "I'm the American poet and all America is beautiful to me, black, white, male, female, you know, every profession from the lowest to the highest." And he wants to embrace everything, and he's becomes a poet of democracy. And then that poet watches as democracy changes and almost fractures and then tries to heal itself. And he documents those things, too, after the war. He has a long book called Democratic Vistas, in which he talks about what has happened, the kind of greed of the Gilded Age. And, of course, one of his most favorite, one of his most well-known poems is When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard bloomed, which is an elegy, of course, to Abraham Lincoln. So there you have these writers really responding to everything that's going on. And we do tend to forget that, but it's rather wonderful to think that they're almost like the photographers. They're there, too, capturing what they saw and felt in words.
Newspaper men like Horace Greeley. Huge impact, right, Brenda?
Huge.
I mean, really just on either way. And am I wrong? At one point, there were more than a dozen newspapers in New York alone, something like that?
Huge number of newspapers, probably in Boston and in Concord and all over. There were so many newspapers. They were, like today, very partisan, like our news shows or whatever today. So we can't think of them as being kind of above us, but that was the way people got information. That's the way they learned about the battlefields. And, you know, the war also brought war correspondents, you know, men who went out into the field and got information to the reader through another newfangled invention, the telegraph. So newspapers became enormously important, and newspaper editors were also very important in shaping public opinion. And you mentioned earlier, go west, young man, that's Horace Greeley. That's his phrase from the New York Tribune, which, although it's located in New York, had, you know, a very large national readership. There was a time of huge journalism where everybody was reading papers all of the time, probably more than one, and certainly there were morning editions and evening editions as well.
And Horace Greeley,
hard
at one
to
point,
imagine.
Yeah. At one point, he runs for president, doesn't he?
Oh, he does. He runs for president. He runs against Grant. He runs. He's a surprising and very complicated figure because he was an anti-slavery man and he was very important in the anti-slavery movement. He was an editor who hired women, which was unusual, as correspondents. So he's very open-minded that way. He and his wife went to seances trying to speak to a lost child. So he was very much part of these times, and so much part of these times that he pushed against Lincoln during the war when he thought Lincoln wasn't moving quickly enough to emancipate the slaves. And then after the war, Horace Greeley decides to run for president, and even the people who put him up who nominated him were very wary about his running. And he ran on a platform of what we would call reconciliation. The North should shake hands with the South. And for many people, that was to give away all of the advantages and all of the things that the North had fought for. Needless to say, as we know from history, Horace Greeley lost, and he was never the same afterwards. He died shortly after the election.
Our phone number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Brenda, let's go to our listeners now. And Bill's been waiting in Concord. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if Dr. Wineapple has ever encountered a photographer from Concord who was pretty well known in the Civil War, Henry P. Moore.
Henry P. Moore. It rings a dim bell.
Yeah, there is a great collection of his photographs at the New Hampshire Historical Society in Concord.
Oh, great.
He worked on kind of behind the lines at Hilton Head Island, South Carolina.
And many
of his photos of slaves are, you know, kind of nationally known. But he was from Concord, and certainly
photographs are in New Hampshire?
Many of the originals are at the Historical Society in Concord.
Oh, that's
great. Some are other places, too, but he was working in the around 1862, 63, I think.
Wow, right in the thick of it.
South Carolina, in the islands, in Beaufort.
Yeah. Right.
Bill, thanks for calling. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
And you know, we talked earlier.
I'm going to come look for him.
Right. Well, we talked earlier about the power of photography, and here you have a guy from New Hampshire going down and photographing slavery. What sort of impact did those photographs have on the abolitionists and those who maybe were on the fence up north?
Well, I think they had a tremendous impact before the war. Insofar as journalists like James Redpath or photographers, there weren't so many before the work as photography wasn't as advanced, would go down and document what the slave conditions were like in the South for a Northern readership. People who, but like any time, people who wanted to turn away and deny what was going on would say, well, that's propaganda, where other people would become inflamed and incensed about the brutality that's implied by one person owning another person. So I'm not sure how much it any changed anyone's opinion, but certainly it solidified and strengthened those who are already anti-slavery.
Speaking of turn away and deny, I have to ask you this, Brendan. I think you know where I'm going with this. You spent a lot of time writing about a remarkable figure of this period, P.T. Barnum, saying that he gave the nation comic relief, distraction from the wrenching debate that was going on. How does he fit into this story?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, one of the things that I uncovered was fascinating to me was that P.T. Barnum was actually interviewed by Walt Whitman. We never think of these people coming together. And then when I stepped back for a moment, I thought, you know, Whitman in a way is the P.T. Barnum of poetry because he's embracing everything. And Barnum, too, is trying to create and exploit both a kind of democracy where he says everyone is welcome, whether it's the, you know, three-headed chicken or, you know, any kind of he put together things he called mermaid or he staged a version of Uncle Tom's Cabin where everything was fine in the end. So it was a kind of distraction. It was like bread and circuses. He did not say a sucker is born every minute, but he might as well have. And he was very much part of the time because he's part of the exuberance of the time. And he's both responding to the time and, of course, selling tickets so that even a young Henry James would go to Barnum's Museum and see what the freak shows, the strangeness, the expanse of an American democracy could be like. So he's a very sort of interesting, colorful figure who in the 1870s also goes out west and in his particular case West is made hospitable to him by General Custer, and Barnum goes on a shooting spree where they shoot buffalo. So again, he's a kind of perfect American figure who's part of all of what goes on, and then, as you say, creates a tremendous distraction, which for him, of course, is money-making.
Well, yeah, and that's the ultimate self-made American man, isn't it? And
They're all self-made at this particular period when you think about it. Yeah, Abraham Lincoln is a self-made man. Whitman is a self-made man and celebrating that in many ways. You know, that was the time of exuberance, that you could make yourself into a powerful newspaper person like Horace Greeley, that you could make a museum that represented America like Barnum, that you could make a new literature and a new poetry like Whitman. And these were self-made, and there was the sense that you could really make yourself over. That comes from Ralph Waldo Emerson, where, you know, you basically decide what you want to be and you can be it. So that there was that sense of hope and excitement.
Well, and after a short break, Brenda, I want to ask you about another issue that did distract some attention from the rising North-South conflict in the years just before the war, and that's the tension, the ultimate bloodshed with the Mormons who were trying to settle out west. So we'll talk about that after a break and take a lot more of your calls at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
When you become an NHPR sustaining member today at $15 a month, we'll send you the Blue Nano. The pocket-sized Bluetooth-enabled speaker is perfect for linking to your phone or MP3 player. We're offering it for a limited time to sustainers at the $15 a month level, so make your gift now. And when you do, you'll also be counted toward our Power Morning goal. Call now at 1-888-805-6477 or visit nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from AutoBeef, a website allowing vehicle owners to share information about car problems and possible solutions, listed by make and model online at carcomplaints.com. And Ansel and Anderson Trust and Estate Attorneys in Bedford, providing estate planning tailored to blended or unconventional families, on the web at anselpa.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with historian and author Brenda Wineapple about her new book called Ecstatic Nation: Confidence, Crisis, and Compromise, 1848 to 1877. We'd love your questions and comments about this amazing period of time in our country's history. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Brenda, so many more different trends and events to ask you about. One we have to talk about is the Mormons making their home in Utah during this period after they were chased out of a couple states. They settled quite successfully in Utah, much to the consternation of many political elites at the time, including President Buchanan. How come?
Well, you know, the Mormons set up, in a sense, a shadow government and a shadow country, in a way. One of the things that was fascinating to me about this particular period is that I didn't realize quite so viscerally how many different movements were happening at the same time. And in America, there was the development of a new religion, Mormonism, which, you know, is very strong today, very much with us today. There were two presidential candidates running recently, and one actually got the nomination, Romney. So Mormons are very much part of the American fabric, but they weren't here always. And it's an American religion. And as you mentioned, the development of the religion also is the development of the West. Mormonism started in upstate New York. And as it grew more and more powerful, it was more or less chased out of certain states like Illinois. Mormons finally settled in Utah. But because it was a kind of closed society and because it really, in some sense, was becoming, as I said, a kind of shadow government, men like President Buchanan became very nervous about this powerful group that was becoming more and more wealthy and that in many ways flouted American values. And there was, of course, that terrible rumor of polygamy that really flew against sense of what America was all about, and certainly what conventional marriage was all about. Even that divided the Mormon community. So it was very interesting what happened, and Buchanan actually sent troops out to fight with the Mormons, but decided not to do it. One of the things that I was interested in was the development of the Mormons, and the strength of the Mormons became something that was important to both Lincoln and Douglas when they were both running for Senate in Illinois. And the question was then, at that particular time, something called popular sovereignty. Should you be able to vote for whatever you want? If the majority votes for, say, slavery, or if a majority votes for polygamy, shouldn't that majority be taken seriously? Isn't that one's right as an American? And that's what Douglas got into trouble about because, of course, if he said that, which he did, that he said that on the slavery issue, then you have to say, well, what happens then on the Mormon issue? And Abraham Lincoln and the Republicans got him on that one.
Yeah, it's interesting. And like so many of the trends, events, characters of this era, so often, Brenda, it comes back to slavery.
Yes, it does come back to slavery. And one can't forget slavery. The era starts, and I start the book with the death of John Quincy Adams. And he was a former president. He was in the House of Representatives. And he had evolved in a way to try to stop the Mexican War because he knew, like the expansion into Cuba, the territory acquired from the Mexican War would start another debate, acrimonious about slavery. That was as early as 1848. And that slavery issue was going to trouble, vex, almost destroy the country because it had gone on, the institution had gone on too long, and it was becoming harder and harder to change. And even after the war, the aftermath, you know, still what slavery meant and how one was going to integrate a former group of people who had been denied literacy, who had been denied work, who had been denied every citizen's right, how that was going to change and be made right.
You know, we talk about Lincoln a lot in this book mm-hmm. and in this overall story, and clearly he's the figure who dominates this period. And you say, though, that Lincoln himself evolved on this issue of slavery. Again, it's easy to look at Lincoln and say he's the guy who freed the slaves, and certainly he was, but he evolved too, didn't he, Brenda?
He did. Everybody had to evolve in a certain way, and early on, he was very careful with what he said. He was always very clear. He was always against the institution of slavery spreading. But early on, and he was very clear about this too, although the Southerners weren't necessarily listening, or at least the radical Southerners, he was clear that he wasn't going to abolish it, that he just didn't want it to spread into the territories. So he was not an abolitionist. And viewed from the abolitionist position, say, of Frederick Douglass, he was thought to be cold and tardy and cautious when it came to slavery. But of course, he had to evolve because of the war, and we know that he was the one who wrote and signed the Emancipation Proclamation, which he very, very much stood by, because the war, of course, changed everything. Here you had a constitutionally elected president being told that you can't be president. And he ran on a platform that didn't abolish slavery. And yet, as you say, he became the man who actually did. So that is an evolution, too, in terms of, you know, how you deal with an institution that's so much part of the American fabric. And finally, he stood up, had to stand up against it.
Well, and you just mentioned another amazing figure from this period mm-hmm. that dominates almost as much as Lincoln, and that's Frederick Douglass. Just, he was kind of the conscience poking at everybody, wasn't he?
He was. He's a wonderful, wonderful figure. Very, very eloquent. Remarkable story when you consider that he was born into slavery, that in many ways, talk about self-made, that he freed himself. Then he is a narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, in a sense like Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin became an enormously successful book internationally, so successful in a sense that he had to leave the country for a while, afraid that he would be recaptured and brought back into slavery, settled ultimately in upstate New York, where he had a very successful newspaper, and spoke and wrote so eloquently before, during, and after this particular period. He was asked, for example, by John Brown to join the insurrection at Harper's Ferry, and he was smart enough and savvy enough and political enough to say no, to think that that was a suicidal attempt, but that he was going to nonetheless apply whatever pressures he could, and they were considerable, to the abolition of slavery and civil rights for the former slaves.
Okay, and here's the big question, Brenda. Civil rights for,
you know,
civil rights for former slaves.
Yeah, well,
just
what
the
about
male
the women,
slaves,
right?
Though, right? So, and this yeah. was real interesting to me to read yeah. about the interplay between civil rights leaders like Frederick Douglass and
sure.
the women's rights leaders like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and so forth. Just yeah. remind us of that interplay and how it got difficult.
It got very difficult. Originally, you know, again, in 1848, in this whole period, the period that brackets the Civil War, one of the things that was very important, besides we mentioned photography or the railroad or even spiritualism, was the women's movement. In 1848, it was a convention of men and women, the Declaration of Rights and Sentiments for Women. What happened when women are challenging the status quo and trying to get civil and equal rights is that they decided that as the country slid to war, that they were going to put their efforts into the war and into the abolition of slavery. But then comes the 13th Amendment, and slavery is abolished, and the question becomes, who is enfranchised? Who gets the vote? And, of course, women think, well, Now everybody gets the vote.
Sure.
Right? Black, white, men, women. And many people in the abolition or anti-slavery movement and in the Republican Party of this particular time said, women have to wait. You know, ladies last, in a sense, that to put women on the same status as men at this particular time would be to torpedo, to subvert, to make impossible the enfranchisement of black men. So women were left out entirely and, as we know, did not get the vote until all the way into 1920. What happened, too, was that people, those against enfranchising either black men or women, tended to pit the two groups against one another, which wasn't hard to do, of course, because the two groups were split. There were people who figured, okay, civil rights, equal rights for all. Why not? And there were others who figured, no, you put women in there and the amendment has no chance for passing, which is shocking and was probably politically correct in terms of what could pass, but horrific when we think about it, especially if we're women.
Well, if you look at it now, you just go, wait a minute. But at the time, you know, it seemed like a lot.
No, but it's a similar to some of the things that go on now, I think. If you think back to 2008 and you remember in the Democratic primaries that you had Barack Obama running against Hillary Clinton, and many people who were suspicious of both of them liked to pit them against one another and say it was a white woman running against a black man. Who are you going to choose? And if you think of that in the 19th century setting, in some ways, men, black men, even black men, former slaves were less intimidating to the status quo than women, which is interesting and has a certain, I think, contemporary resonance.
Let's take another call if we could, Brenda. And Chris is calling from Concord. Hi, Chris. Thanks for hanging on. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks. I was just wondering how the Southern social system changed after the abolishment of slavery in the South.
Yeah, good question, Chris. Thank you.
Well, the social system had to change, and it was a tremendous rupture. First of all, the South was decimated. Most of the war, you know, with the exception of, say, Gettysburg, most of the war is fought in the South. When you think about that and you think of what was burned, you know, you think of Atlanta burning, you think of Columbia, South Carolina burning, you think of people accusing each other that the Confederates burned it so that the Union soldiers wouldn't have it, or the Union soldiers were just, you know, tearing everything up, you know, with it was a devastated landscape. And there, after the war, unlike, say, after World War II, where much money went into the rehabilitation of Europe and Germany, there wasn't enough money going into the South, and the whole landscape became very contentious. At first, blacks and Republicans were able to get into office, but over time there was a kind of sense of a reaction against that development, and certainly because after the death of Abraham Lincoln and the administration of Andrew Johnson really, from Tennessee, was not at all sympathetic to the civil rights legislation and the Reconstruction efforts that were going on, and he turned them back in a certain sense. So the South suffered enormously, and change was very slow to come in that particular era. And I think it's a really tragic story, because there was so much promise at that particular time.
Well, it is shocking how much violence continued against African Americans after the Civil War. Just, you know, scores of people just slaughtered for no apparent particular reason. And you write, Brenda, that after the war ended, after the Civil War ended, the wars continued, all kinds of wars, you say, that killed people of all kinds of races. So the country didn't just quiet down after the war was over. I mean, all kinds of violence continued.
No, it's interesting when you think about it. It's hard to quiet down after a war is over. I mean, many people are exhausted, and I think a kind of exhaustion often is used to explain why it was that the energy of the anti-slavery movements didn't seem to hold through in Reconstruction. But I think it's more complicated than that. And I think, as you say, and you know, that there were so many wars going on. There were wars on the street in New Orleans, Memphis. There was white fighting black, certainly. There was a tremendous amount of mob violence. There were also wars that went on in the West. And when you think of the kind of continuation of the Union soldier being sent out now, who wasn't demobilized, but actually sent out to the West to clear out the settlements and the territories there, make them available for white settlers who wanted to move in that direction. And what that entailed was often the decimation of Native American tribes. So those wars continued. They were actually being fought during the Civil War and became very pronounced after the war. So it was the violence of the war and the violence that the war unleashed took a long time to dissipate. And I think it was a very difficult time of reunion. And in some ways, there wasn't a reunion.
So this is a remarkable portrait of the nation in this remarkable period and all the people and the war and the animosity. But as you said, Brenda, hope, ingenuity. Mm-hmm. What lessons do you think we can learn from studying these years that you explore an ecstatic nation? You know, how can we use these lessons and this incredible time period to inform our understanding of current conflicts and current debates today?
Well, that's an excellent question. And I think in the simplest sense, I would have to say, especially given what's going on right now in the midst of a government shutdown, is that people really need to learn to listen to one another and to really think about the history of America, what compromise can mean, what it has meant, what the inability to compromise certainly can lead to, what is meant by federal control versus states control, and what it is, what kind of vision that we want for a country. The only way to, I think, implement that particular vision is, sounds like a cliche, but to both keep hope alive and to keep one's ears open.
Well, Brenda, it's been great to talk to you. Good luck with the book. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure and a delight. Thanks for your time.
Brenda Wineapple. Again, she teaches literature at both New York's New School University and Columbia University. The book we talked about is called Ecstatic Nation. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteers, Priscilla Malcolm and John Barrett. The executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org. Power Morning is your chance to shorten the on-air fundraiser so you can hear more of all the great things you tune in to NHPR for. Quality, in-depth news and information. The goal is to raise a full day's worth of funds in just 4 hours, and when you help us do that, we'll cancel the drive for the rest of the day. We're doing it all on the first day of our fall fund drive, Wednesday, so when you call now, your gift will be counted towards our goal. Or make your gift online at nhpr.org.
This is NHPR. It's 9:59. Good morning. The Donnie and Bean Show next at 10. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Small Dog Electronics, offering Dr. Small Dog house calls for home and business, Mac and PC technical service and repair. Online at smalldog.com/doctor. And New Hampshire Magazine this month featuring the Beer Lover's Guide to the Granite State and a look at the state's two shaker communities. New Hampshire Magazine, where New Hampshire comes to you.
These are the states.